evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Bill Myers. Myers is the founder and CEO of Alternatives Federal Credit Union. Throughout its 28-year existence, he has provided strategic direction and hands-on management to this innovative, unique, and very successful enterprise. He plans to retire from Alternatives in June of 2007. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Well, thanks so much, Tish.
You know what I see streaming through your life is this philosophy about building community and including people like poor people who've really been overlooked. Where did this philosophy of yours come from in those early days?
Well, I'm a 60s guy. I went to school at Cornell, and my first year at Cornell, the university was closed down at the end of the year, so there's a lot of the sense of justice in my work. Economic justice is where it ended up, and local control seemed like the appropriate way to address empowerment concerns. The credit union originally was started by a group called the Alternatives Fund, a group of local small businesses that found they didn't have access to the kind of credit they need to expand their business. So my first involvement with the credit union was in finding out what kind of institution would best serve their needs. We looked around. We looked at, you know, bank forms, private loan forms, a loan fund, a community development corporation, lots of options, and decided on credit unions mainly because at that point there were no regulations for business lending for credit unions. So it was pre the emergence of regulation in that area. It allowed us to be pretty innovative, which became sort of an addiction to let's try things out.
Absolutely.
And
you know what else I want to ask you? You were a founding partner in the Oasis Natural Foods store in the early 70s, too. Now, how did you get into that?
Well, it was a group of people I lived with, and we were just looking for employment. And I think there's a thread of that in Ithaca, and I think one of the strengths of Ithaca is people want to stay here. People like the lifestyle, but often can't find the employment that they want for that. So a lot of people choose self-employment. And again, that's been a strength of the credit union as well. We have something like 1,200 small businesses members. They're just a huge reservoir of people who try things out on their own. And that market at that time for me was really appropriate. As I say, I used to be a baker and just added an N, and I'm a banker. So
that's interesting. You were a baker, huh?
A baker. So just one letter difference.
But you know, something else I found surprising in your resume is that you ventured into electoral politics as well. You became an alderman.
That's true.
In the Ithaca.
80 to 84.
And how was that for you?
Well, I worked actually right before that in Connie Cook's office when she was VP of Cornell. Mm-hmm. She was Cornell's lobbyist. And there was a nice feeling in that office. She was an inspiring, incredibly ethical person who had, in the 50s and forward, really brought the abortion rights issue to a forefront in this state. Really a wonderful woman. Mm-hmm. And working for her, it seemed like there were opportunities there. And in 1979, about the time the credit union started, ran for Common Council and was on Common Council 80 to 84.
Well, what were some of the issues that you brought to your campaign when you first started to run?
Oh, goodness. Well, that's, you know, 24 years ago. So I wonder.
Perhaps legalizing marijuana.
No, not at all. You know, it was I think it was more representation. That Common Council at that time, in that particular election, went through a change from a fairly sleepy group, and I mean that literally, that there were people who fell asleep during the meetings.
No kidding.
That you know, I mean, wonderful, but older folk who didn't have much energy for the job, but had
tons of time.
Were willing to show up and not do much. And there were a group of three of us who ran together, and not necessarily on the same platforms, but the idea of, you know, let's bump the thing up a notch. And it was a interesting time. I think the lessons I learned, a lot of it was about process, about how to make things happen, but also about how process impeded, how, as I think you see with the Common Council and the mayor right now, they're making decisions when the way they look at the world is narrowly confined, that, well, we can't do this with a garage because those decisions were made years ago.
Yeah.
And the frustrating thing about the way that process is managed is there's no open field decision. And I heard one councilman say it. I want to make a decision about environmental programs, and I've sat here for 3 years and never been asked to vote on that. You never get the issue you want right in front of you. You always get issues that are peripheral concern or that people are lobbying about. It was an interesting experience, but not how I wanted to spend my life.
Yeah, I can understand that. But it seems to me you could have brought some of the innovative ideas that you brought to alternatives to politics, perhaps.
That's right. I was a lot younger, and it was a learning experience, too, of how the process works, and little things like, well, we're going to pass a plan for the inland area. It's just a plan. You don't have to worry about the details of it. Mm. We're going to pass it. And then in the next iteration, it'd be, well, we're going to do this because it's in the plan, so you don't have to worry about it because you've already approved the plan that's in it. And we're going to increase. We said it was going to cost a little bit of money, but it's going to cost a lot more. But you don't have to worry about it because you already proved the base amount of money.
Exactly.
The decisions roll on themselves. And unless you're well aware of that, you end up, I think, as administrations do, halfway through the term, realizing that your agenda has not even started moving.
Yeah, exactly.
It takes a lot of concentration and focus and power to move your agenda along.
I've talked to some people who've run for Common Council and said, you know, all your good intentions, you're still going to end up being part of the institution.
Yeah.
And you have to be incredibly energetic and assertive and so on to try to move
that. And skilled. I mean, I think that's for me, it was a learning experience. I learned a lot of skills that served me well. How are you effective in a meeting setting? How do you manage the meeting so it doesn't last to 1 or 2 in the morning?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
How do you trade your vote? How do you make sure that you bring people along and make sure that they're treated well on the other side of that vote?
Mm-hmm.
Good skills to have.
Yeah, exactly.
So
amid all this stuff that you were involved in, Oasis and so on, you decide to start a bank. Tell us how alternatives, how the inception.
Well, part of the reason that we went with a credit union is that the threshold for starting was so low. You essentially had to get, I think it was just six or seven people to sign. They
really?
Each had to agree to deposit $5. So the sort of legacy is, and I think we got 12 people, and we started with $60 on the first day in deposits.
My God, that's amazing.
There's a long process of getting deposit insurance, which is really the key. But unlike a bank, I'm on a bank board now working to charter a bank in New York, who's a bank that's doing some wonderful stuff. But we're 3 years and $4 million into the process. The credit union costs us $60 to start. It's a much different process. Of course, that meant on the first day, all we had was $60 to work with, too. So there's a price to pay. And the price is that it takes a long time to grow it. You grow it step by step. The benefit, you're not beholden to anyone as you grow. You can do what you want, but you don't have much to work with. I remember when we first started, we maybe worked a year and a half to get the charter. We got the charter. We had a few bucks. The National Trade Association for Credit Unions sent us a 3-foot cubic box full of here's how to do this, manuals. So we divided it up and said, well, you take this manual and you do this. You learn credit. I'll learn supervision. You do the accounting. And it was really a do-it-yourself process. I mean, in some ways, it's a wonderful type of institution.
It is. A grassroots.
And so you're not beholden in the end. The only party you really owe something to is your regulator, who insures the deposits, and that's over the years an extremely special relationship. That whenever anybody puts money in the credit union or in other insured depository, the federal government is going to stand behind it. And our relationship with those regulators, who their sole concern is, we never want you to charge money against us. We'll back you, but we never want to hear from you that you're losing money.
I'm not surprised.
So it's this relationship of. I mean, I've had regulators say to me, you know, you guys are wonderfully innovative and you do all the new stuff and there's leading edge stuff. There's stuff that we do that the whole field has adopted. But they say, you know, just like tomorrow when I'm there, just don't do anything new. or if you do something new, make it not risky. And it's sort of a basic misunderstanding of how the market economy works. It is about taking risk. It is. And banks have this incredibly special place in a market economy where, in a certain sort of way, they are the primary gatekeepers for activity.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you do in a market economy needs money, and every piece of money has to flow through a bank.
Mm-hmm.
So, in some ways, allowing the local economy to develop along its own lines is the function of the banks in that economy. And it's a wonderful institution that allows us to pool our money together and then decide what kind of society we want to create. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's the responsibility of everything you try doesn't work.
Yeah.
We're a very experimental and innovative institution, and lots of things we try don't work. Although we have lots of programs that are copied nationally, we have many, many more than that that disappear from view because they didn't work.
And
so our institution presents a special problem for the regulators, but a special opportunities for the field, we think, as well.
I would assume so. I know that early on you stressed the importance of participation of managers and participating in the institution in all aspects of it. Do you still believe that that's important and that was part of your success?
Yeah, I think honestly, I'm fairly poorly suited to be a manager. My motivation is I want to do things that I like. And I'm challenged by finance. I'm challenged by the problems that I see in our community and building a financing tool or a partnership that can address those problems. It's really fun. And I want the people that work with me to be similarly motivated. I want them to see the challenges. I want them to be proud of the work we can do. And the successes are substantial and highly impactful. But in the real world, there's 10,000 other issues you have to deal with.
Exactly.
That kind of stuff, I never ask for, not directly, but that's the way the world works. That's running a business. You know, now we have 43 employees, and I like to say right now there's 43 people who, when they've got a problem they don't like, or when they have a buck that they want to stop somewhere, it ends up on my desk. And I sort of wonder, how in the heck did I get in this kind of a position? I never wished it, but that's the way it works.
Well, I think part of your success is the fact that you haven't been a traditional CEO. People think of CEOs as sitting in some gilded office, untouchable, you know, and you've been totally involved, hands-on in this institution.
Well, I certainly think, as you alluded to before, certainly earlier on we had more sharing of responsibility, so that we'd have lots of staff doing a little piece of everything. We've had more differentiation right now, although not nearly as much as other institutions, and we have a, along with our livable wage policy, a strong policy of promoting within. So many people in our institution, many and maybe even most, have held more than one job inside the institution. And that provides, obviously, a greater depth and understanding of the mission, but also that same kind of spreading out where people understand, I know what it's like to be a teller because I've done it.
Mm-hmm.
I know what it's like to answer the phone when people are yelling at you because it's happened a lot of times. You know, so there's not a sense of I don't understand the kind of work you're doing, or I don't understand the situation, and I'm going to be, you know, pushy about that because I can't relate. And certainly all of our senior management have been in those positions, understand that, and have empathy for that, even if it's not something that they end up doing every day.
Yeah. So did you discourage people saying, it's not my job?
Yeah. I think what I would rather have people say, and there's a great book called A Complaint is a Gift, that the best thing a member or client can do for you is complain, that it shows a certain faith in you, that if they were mistreated or they had a concern about the service and they chose to walk away without talking to you, it represents a lack of trust in your ability to resolve it. Mm. And when someone complains, it represents a level of trust. No matter how unpleasant the experience is, they're giving you an opportunity to repair, and that feedback is the most valuable thing. And really, it's where most of our innovation comes from. It's where members come in and say, I want this, and we can't give it to them. And that's where innovation happens, because then we can filter it, trying to understand what they need and how we could deliver it, how we could design products, who we could partner with, where we could get funding, where we'd make money. That's the key part to it. So listening to our members, not necessarily the compliments, and I think it's also, you know, my personality. I feel much more comfortable with people who complain to me than people who compliment me. That it's extremely rare that someone complains insincerely.
Mm. Oh, exactly.
And so I feel like I can immediately, in an odd sort of way, establish rapport with someone who's complaining at me because I know they're being honest. Mm-hmm. And someone who's complimenting me, I have to parse it out and figure out.
What do they want?
Yeah, they, you know, just blowing around or, you know. Yeah, exactly. What motivation do they have? So, again, our way of working is trying to understand what members want, trying to resolve those problems, and if we can't pass it into a new product design so we can figure out how to solve those problems. Obviously, you're never wholly successful in that, but, you know, it's a fun effort.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Myers. He's the CEO and founder of Alternatives Federal Credit Union. Now, I want to talk to you about this. Back in 1989, you called affordable housing a crisis in Tompkins County. It still seems to be. What's going on with that?
Yeah.
Is there a solution?
I think 1989 was after the most part of the savings and loan crisis, which decimated the financing mechanisms of this country. It was a cataclysmic shift from the old regime, which we used to call 363. You pay 3%, you charge 6%, you go to the golf course at 3. 363. It was an old banker's rule.
Uh-huh.
And it was true. Banks used to close at 3, and they did charge
those
rates.
I remember, yeah.
But in the early 80s, that all fell apart, and the demise of the savings and loan industry, $3 trillion. The amount of money we lost on savings and loan industry was enough to put every person in America in a home. It's a huge amount of money, and honestly reminds me of you know, some of the wartime activities. If you spend that on productive stuff, which we don't, it could change the society. The savings and loan crisis cost us as much to put everybody in America in a home of their own. A huge amount of money down the tubes, but there it was. After we came out of that, I think before that, there were fixed rate mortgages, after variable rate, trying to build products that didn't endanger the borrower. There were several products that graduated payment mortgages, GPM, where you start off with a low payment that didn't represent the full amortizing value of the loan. No matter what you did, that payment was going to go up over years, assuming that you were going to become a yuppie and earn a lot more money.
Mm.
Just a terrible loan. It's a bad deal. And products like that came out of the crisis. And I think in some ways the crisis that we faced in 1989 was a different sort of crisis. It was a financing crisis. And in some ways that crisis really was dealt with. There's financing options out there, and you're seeing 0% down mortgages. Mm-hmm. There's lots of...
So you're saying that you think things are better now?
No, I'm not. Oh, I'm okay. Saying it's a different problem.
It's a different kind of problem.
But it hasn't gotten better. It's just gotten different.
The
financing crisis, there's a lot of creative solutions that came out of that series of problems, that now you can get a 0% mortgage. Now, it used to be that if you have a gift for down payment, it was excluded from your calculations. Now there's differences. It used to be that if your home needed repair, you couldn't get it financed. Now you can have set-asides for home. There's lots of solutions. There's even some stuff going on now where if you don't have a credit rating, there's alternative credit bureaus that will allow you to use your rent payments as a proxy for a credit score. Lots of improvements.
That's interesting.
But I think the crisis now, and the study last year from the Vermont group in the county, showed that the next crisis is twofold. First, that housing prices have gone so high that the median home is not affordable to the medium household. That there's a mismatch, that you have to be richer than average to afford the average home. That doesn't work. So what the county solution in the report anyway was that over the next decade, 75% of the new housing built has to be affordable. That is, we don't need more homes for rich people. We need more affordable stuff. But on the other hand, the construction market isn't allowing that. It's much easier to build a high-end home than a low-end home. And I think part of the solution here in our community has to do with mixed-use housing, which is very hard to finance, the kind of stuff where you have retail on the first floor and potential housing on the second and third floor. There's not many financing options. It's not nearly as easy to find financing for that as single-family. And the other one is multifamily. We simply don't have good options for owner-occupied multifamily. And there are some national models. South Shore Bank in Chicago has what they call a ma-and-pa landlord, where they cultivate landlords to own homes and manage them. It's a neat model. And I think for affordable housing, we are not going to be able to have standalone, your yard, your place on the street, affordable housing in this county. We're going to have to talk about multifamily, and that needs financing options to make that happen.
Yeah.
So it's the same crisis, but it's taken a different hue than it had.
You know, you also had this very innovative thing. I don't know if you're still doing it. In 1992, you were doing something called efficient car discount for people
to
buy cars and get loans. Are you still doing that?
No. We've actually...
talk to us a little bit about what that was.
It's
very interesting.
Well, I think there's a lot of attempts we've made at how to bring environmental sustainability into finance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've made incredible progress in bringing people of modest means into the mainstream economy. And we've developed lots of products. With sustainable finance, the market is much newer. We looked at restrictions. Like when we first opened, we wouldn't loan for 8-cylinder cars. Just
really?
We wouldn't. We don't want to do that kind of stuff. We still don't loan for motorized recreational vehicles.
Well, what about SUVs?
Well, we allow 8-cylinder because people who are tradesmen are saying, I can't have a 4-cylinder pickup truck. I carry heavy stuff.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's sort of at the point unknowingly limited it to a certain marketplace. We've also given incentives for energy efficient cars based on the EPA rating, but we also found that again inadvertently said, if you've got four kids, you can't get a car at that rate because there are no energy-efficient cars that are that large enough to carry a large
family. Which is another issue altogether. Why aren't there,
Yeah, well, that's true, but there it is.
Uh-huh.
We've also looked at bundling products so that you create a bundle of energy-efficient products. I mean, the easiest way to say it would be you buy, and this is a small example, but you buy a green refrigerator that costs a little bit more, but you finance that so that the energy savings offset the interest cost of the loan.
Interesting idea.
So from your point of view, as a consumer, you're paying the same amount of cash out. It's just for a while you're paying a loan, and then you pay reduced energy cost. But trying to bundle those products together so as a consumer you don't get stuck with that stuff. We've also looked at education stuff, especially for our small businesses, how to meet the new energy cost, whereas sort of the consumer approach, how can you deal with the paper in your office, how can you move more towards paperless in training our businesses. But we haven't had as much success in that area on the consumer stuff. We've also done a lot of modeling where we just say, we're going to do it right. So, for instance, our new building is a green building. There's all the carpets are recycled carpets in it. It's highly energy efficient. The lights are energy efficient. The energy systems are well designed. Try to build that so that it isn't that hard.
Yeah.
So other people will model off it.
You just have to think ahead about some of that stuff.
Well, but some of the areas, and I think here's one of the problems with the environmental stuff for us, is that we're on the finance side of stuff. So we've talked to people about, for instance, putting solar panels on our building. We've looked at the financing models, and when people say, there's a 10-year payback, they're not actually including the cost of money in the. And for us, that's a cardinal sin.
Mm-hmm.
Rent for money is sort of our business. So when we build a model showing that actually, if we put, to pick a number, $100,000 into solar panels, that $100,000 cost us $500 a month. Because we could have made money on that. And then when you add those costs into it, we haven't found, for instance, solar panels that make sense for us. So the nice thing about solar panels is compared to everything else you've done, everybody could see them and they could look at them and they could know what they do and say, this is wonderful, whether it is or not. When you walk across a recycled carpet that off-gases not at all, which is reused carpet, nobody knows that's what it is. So it doesn't have the same kind of impact. So we've had a little trouble with those areas expressing that modeling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other side is we've looked at European models and been disappointed that the European banks have gone so much further than us in that sustainable finance. And part of it is there's a stick on the other side of it. The government requires life cycle costing for materials that require companies to take stuff back. Our government doesn't treat it that way.
Exactly.
And although we do some lobbying, at this point, it's Not happening. Our government's not stepping forward.
I know. You know, when I lived in the Netherlands in the early 1990s, I was so shocked that some of the people I met would say things like, well, it's illegal not to recycle.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe it.
That's right.
It's so amazing how different things are.
Right. And not just on a consumer level, on a corporate level as well.
Exactly.
That the corporations have to accept the materials back.
Yeah. You know what? Before we do run out of time, I want to ask you why you've decided to retire. I know you're leaving an institution that's on incredibly solid ground, but do you still have dreams for it when you leave?
Well, I do. I do. But I feel like the board is in a good place. We have a great board. We have a great management staff. We have some exciting opportunities in front of us. And deciding to not wait until a bus hit me to step down, to pick the point myself and to say, this is the right point for the institution to change directions. It's really about that the institution has a stable bevy of products, that we have a good staff, and we're really at the point where expansion is our next goal, either opening a branch or doing a merger or sponsoring another credit union, that kind of relationship, which is a different direction than we've taken in the past. I think it requires a different sort of manager. And we've talked about it, not a succession. It's not someone stepping into my shoes. It's a transition. Mm-hmm. It's a changing direction. We're turning a corner, and turning a corner, you don't look back because you don't see what's behind you. You look forward. And I think this is a good time to look forward for the institution to take a step into a broader future than we have. Again, I talked about my management skills. I like to manage people that I can see that are all in my office. And that's, honestly, that's not a great skill these days. Mm. And I think we're looking going forward for someone who, we can do remote branches, no trouble. I can manage that.
I see. One final question. In your letter to members announcing your retirement, you said this: my ambitions were modest, to end up on the positive side of the cosmic balance sheet and to find an engaging way to spend a day or more. How did you do?
Oh. It was certainly more than a day.
Well, what about the positive side of the cosmic balance sheet?
Well, I think about that a lot, and I think about, not in a morbid way, but think about looking back on my life from my deathbed, and the idea of a credit union manager that looks back and, as you said, sort of says, I saved a guy a quarter a point on his SUV financing. Totally unsatisfying to me. And there are members that we have changed their lives for the better, and I think that's all there is to it, that there are people who wouldn't be as well off if our institution wasn't there. And for me, that's enough. That's good.
That's great. That's great. Bill Myers, thank you so much for being with us, and we do wish you well in the future. Well,
thanks so much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.